Now today, we welcome back Terry Fair, who used to be a member here, and it's great to see you again, Terry. And we're really looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Terry is a former member here, and she currently attends a Mennonite church in Prince Albert, where she's employed as a psychologist at the Saskatchewan Penitentiary. She's fortunate to have work that she finds both meaningful and fascinating. In her spare time, she suffers the slings and arrows of parenting adolescents, takes great pleasure in making music with friends, hangs out with her new pup, Hero, and watches her favorite television show. Can you guess? Criminal Minds. There. So, Terry, we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say to us today.
I'm really, really happy to have an opportunity to talk to you about my work. I love my work, and it's not always something that... Well, first of all, you don't hear people say that very often these days, that they love their work and they look forward to going to work in the morning. I genuinely do. Every day is different, and I do a lot. I have a lot of different tasks that I perform over the course of the week, and it's all interesting, and it's all exciting, and it's all, I believe, work that needs to be done. And leaves an impact. At least I believe I make an impact on the people that I work with. That's not necessarily true in the whole institution. I wish I'd had your readings before I started figuring out what I was going to say to you, because now I kind of feel like I'm preaching to the choir. You get it. And that's awesome. I want to talk a little bit about my spiritual journey before I get started. I grew up in a Mennonite family. It was a very fundamentalist, very rigid family. But it wasn't a tremendously traditional family. You know, my mom wore a lipstick and my dad wore a necktie. So, you know, we were with the world. Kind of keeping pace with the world. My dad always had a nice car. And my mom's house was always immaculate, and those were the things that was kind of the standards. I left the Mennonite church for ethical reasons when I was about 16 years old, and I won't go into that story. It's a long story. I left, and I went off to university and got married to a Lutheran, so I did some time in the Lutheran church, and then we got divorced. And then I hooked up with a Catholic, so I did some time in the Catholic Church. And then I met Unitarians. And my whole world went to hell in a handbasket. Because I was introduced to paganism and feminist theology and all of those wonderful things. So when I left Regina, I felt very much at home in this congregation. And so when I left Regina to go farther north, I was lonely spiritually. And I got to Prince Albert eventually, and my parents wanted to go to church one Sunday morning. They came for a visit. They wanted to go to church. And I said, well, there's a Mennonite church. Let's go. So we went to this Mennonite church, and I was astounded by how similar the Mennonite church was in feel to the Unitarian fellowship that I had attended in Regina. So I kind of stayed there. And they seemed to accept me there, despite my unconventional approach to my spirituality. And so that's where I want to begin, because shortly after I started attending that church, somebody said to me, well, are you a Christian then? And I thought about that, that kind of depends what you mean by a Christian. See, if you're the kind of Christian who thinks that believing that Jesus died for your sins to save you from hell and damnation, then I would have to say no. That's not where I sit on that spectrum. But if you're the kind of Christian who believed that when Jesus said, I come to destroy the old law and replace it with a new law, and that new law is love. It's very simple, very straightforward. It's not a law, it's a guideline. Then count me in. So that's my understanding in a nutshell of my faith at this point in time. And I still have a labyrinth in my backyard, and I still celebrate the full moon, and I still celebrate the new moon, and I still go to church, and I'm, you know, I've kind of incorporated all of those things in my life, and I really enjoy it. So, I did promise I wasn't going to swear this morning, didn't I? Because you're recording it. Okay, I won't swear. I work in a jail. Swearing is de rigueur. So I wanted to share with you a little bit about how I work with my clients, just to give you kind of a direction. A fellow will come into my office, and I introduce myself. And I will explain where I'm coming from in terms of our relationship. That's how I start. And I say to him, from a spiritual perspective, I will love you as I love everyone else in my life. And I'll never forget what you did. And I'll never forget why you're here. So don't mess with me. And they go, oh, well, that works for me. So they know what the boundaries are right away. And they believe me when I say that I will love them the way I love everyone else in my life to the best of my ability. And so I want to talk a little bit about what that means. Because I think in our society, we sometimes... We sometimes have misconceptions of what love is about. So when I tell people this story about how I say, I will love my offenders, they say, oh, no. No, you mustn't love your offenders. That's too personal. Well, I don't love them in a romantic sense. Certainly not. That's, I don't love them in a friendly sense, in the sense that I'm their best friend, and I love them in the sense that they are human beings, just like me, and I look for myself. Help me see the part of me that lives inside of you. I look for myself in them, and I try to reflect back to them the part of them that is in me. And to me, that's what love is. It's knowing sometimes that we never really understand another person's context. So when I'm doing a range walk, I go to talk to somebody and he doesn't want to talk to me and he tells me to F off. I don't need to be upset about that. I need to understand that he didn't sleep last night because somebody was playing their ghetto blaster too loud, and that's his only way to respond to me. He doesn't have other options sometimes. There's an interesting cartoon that I found on Facebook. Said Jesus giving a sermon, and he says, love one another. And somebody puts up their hand and says, well, what about gays and lesbians and criminals and all those bad people? And Jesus says, excuse me, did I stammer? It's clear, love one another. Understand their context. Be open to what another person has to teach you. And that will afford you the opportunity to teach them something too. So as I was raising my kids, I tried to teach them not the do's and don'ts of life, but the how to discover the do's and don'ts yourself of life. And I would say to them, when you're deciding how to behave in the world, what to do, how to act, ask yourself first, does this action come from a place of love within me? And if it doesn't come from a place of love within you, and be very honest with yourself about that, then probably it's not the best idea. But if it does come from a place of love, even if it might create problems for you, then it could be the right thing to do. Raising your hand and asking a question that upsets somebody's apple cart is kind of scary, but maybe it's the right thing to do. So, loving people generally is difficult at the best of times. I work with a couple of people that challenge my commitment to be a loving person. They get under my skin. Sometimes they complain a lot. Sometimes they do stuff that I think is kind of iffy professionally. And I have to remind myself that I don't understand their context either. And sometimes it's hard to love them. I have a 16-year-old daughter. And I have to admit that on some days, she's darn hard to love. We love her anyway, right? Those of you who have children, you love your children anyway, even when they grow up and move away and do all of those things. And so that's the kind of attitude I try to bring into my relationship with the offenders in jail. The other thing that I want to talk about, and I should, before I go much farther and get myself into hot water, I'm talking here from my own perspective. I'm not representing CSC in any way, shape, or form. I'm just talking to you about my own experience and my own approach. And hopefully you understand that things in CSC are different from the way I'm presenting myself. The other thing that Jesus said, somebody said to him, how often should you forgive somebody? Does anyone know the answer to that? Just out of curiosity. How often should you forgive somebody? 70 times 7, 490 times. Well, that's a lot. And sometimes forgiving people is difficult. But if you withhold forgiveness, you withhold healing for yourself. The withholding of forgiveness is hardly ever of any consequence to the person who's being forgiven, and it is always of consequence to the person who withholds forgiveness, always. And so forgiving people, no matter what, is an important aspect of being whole as individuals, but also as a community. If we can't forgive people within our community, then we live in fear always. Well, what does it mean to forgive? Well, it means what I said earlier. I'll love you, but I won't forget what you did. I won't forget who you are or why you're in jail. But in this moment, I will see the good in you. I choose to see the good in you, and I choose to let go of the harm that you've done. Now, I have a client who comes. He's actually a resident at Saskatchewan Penitentiary. He's been in jail for 40 years, and he comes to visit occasionally. Now, in 40 years, he got caught with a brew once. He got caught in another place where he wasn't supposed to be. Now, he committed two heinous crimes when he was younger. He's 65 now, I think. He committed two terrible, terrible crimes. The first one took him less than 15 minutes to commit. And the second one took him, it took him the better part of the day because it involved some planning. And yet he's lived for 65 years in jail. And in that time, he's done some really, really interesting things. He's kind of educated himself. He started a business doing in the framing shop. He frames things. Doesn't get paid much for it. He has learned how to express concern for others. At one time he was diagnosed as a psychopath. But in my experience of him, he has the capacity to be very caring and very concerned about other people. He said to me the other day, "I'm worried that you're having financial troubles." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because you're getting so thin." And he says, "You are no longer a prosperous woman." And I said, "Yeah, well, that's a story all by itself." But you know, I mean, he is concerned about other people. So am I supposed to judge him now based on who he is now in this moment, or am I supposed to judge him based on the events that brought him to prison in the first place? In my opinion, I have to take him at face value. Who is he right now? And that means letting go of the things that I know he did. I read his file several times, and it weren't pretty. But now, he's grown up. He's improved himself. So, forgiveness is a hugely important part of criminal justice, as far as I'm concerned. Now, what love and forgiveness dovetail with one another, and the way that that happens, in my opinion, is that what prevents us from loving is fear, most often. And so when we continue to withhold forgiveness, that's often fueled by fear. You see, if I forgive, then I give them an opportunity to reoffend. And I'm talking now in personal lives. I'll be personal here. I was married to John, and many of you know him, and I withheld forgiveness from John for a long time. When I let go, and I'd never said to him, "You know what, John, I forgive you." I don't even know if he knows that I needed to do that. But when I let go, my life became much better. I wasn't afraid of him anymore. And our relationship with one another improved. And now we can parent together in a civilized and even cordial manner, which makes me regret sometimes that I didn't do that a long time ago. But what was I afraid of? I was afraid that he would harm me again. And that fear kept me from forgiving, and the withholding of forgiveness kept me from loving. So it's a cyclical kind of thing. So I'm one of those people, I believe that what happens to me as an individual is reflected in the community as a whole. So we as individuals are microcosms of our community, which is a microcosm of our society, which is a microcosm of our world. And so let me take a look, let's just take a look for a minute, because I want to leave some time for questions. Let's take a minute at what our criminal justice system is called. We call it the Correctional Service of Canada. Two interesting words, correctional. In other words, we want the people who enter it as clients to learn better ways of being in our society, more useful ways of being in our society, less harmful ways of being in our society. So correctional is the first thing. The second thing is service. It's a service. We are performing a service for the community, but we are also performing a service for the offenders who live in our institutions. It's a service. Now, going back to some of the things that Jesus taught, Jesus said, you can't be a leader unless you know how to serve. When you know how to serve, then you can stand up and then you have earned the right to lead. So I want to contrast that with the penal system of Canada. We don't call it the penal system of Canada. I work in a penitentiary, which is still based, rooted in that word, penal, right? But we're not supposed to be in the business of punishing people. We're not supposed to be in the business of making them suffer for their crimes. The very situation of being in jail is a horrible thing for most people. Although I have to admit that some days I wish I could sleep there overnight. I wish sometimes that somebody would put me in segregation for a week so that nobody would bother me and I could get some stuff done. But it doesn't work out that way. We send people to jail because they've demonstrated a willingness to behave in ways that endanger us as individuals and as a community. We send them there to protect ourselves and to protect them from themselves. You have, it's interesting to note how many of the fellows that I work with are fearful of their own behavior. I just know that I'm going to get out there and I'm going to feel all confused and I won't know what to do and I'll do something crazy and stupid before I have a chance to think it through properly. In the last month and a half, I do a lot of emergency work and most of that has to do with people who are suicidal. And in the last month and a half, I've dealt with three fellows who were on the verge of release, who were having suicidal thoughts because they were so afraid of what was going to happen to them once they were released into the community. And they weren't sex offenders. That's a whole other topic, and I know I promised to talk about that a long time ago and didn't follow through. But they haven't been prepared properly. These poor fellows have not been, we should have prepared them for their release. But when they came into the institution, they were just criminals and we didn't understand their context. And we didn't know what to do with them. And in order to prepare them adequately for their release, and maybe we're still thinking it's tough bananas. You landed in jail. Now this is the consequence of your bad decision making. So the point is, what we want to do with offenders, if we look at it from a loving, caring, and forgiving perspective, it's important to teach them to manage themselves and their behaviors so that they no longer pose a threat to the community and they no longer pose a threat to themselves. Now, there's a whole category of offenders who really need to be in jail, and they need to be in jail for a long time because they just cannot function without that structure. But I don't understand that as punishment. I understand that as giving them what they need in order to be at peace in the world. We want to teach them skills and behaviors that they can see so that they can see the benefits of using them. How would behaving this way be better for me, and how can I make that happen? Well, since Sandra brought Hero up, my hero, H-I-R-O, by the way, Hero is a little dog about this big, and he has one goal in life, and that's to make me happy. I could use a man like that. And I think all prospective parents and all prospective correctional workers should have a dog first. This is not because I think that offenders are dogs or children are dogs. It's because dogs present us with a simplified version of what it takes to teach something effectively and relatively painlessly. Now, there's a joke, a story I heard. I don't know if it's a joke. I think it might even be a true story about a fellow who had a dog. And the dog, he was trying to housebreak the dog. So every time the dog pooped or peed on the floor, he would grab the dog and rub his nose in it and then throw him outside. Well, after a couple of weeks of that, the dog would poop or pee on the floor, rub his own nose in it, and then ask to be let out. And sometimes I think that's how we're doing corrections. We take somebody who's done something wrong and we rub his nose in it for X number of years and then we let him go. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, I've had other pets, and I've had some children. So by the time I got Hero, I had a little experience with all of this stuff. And the reason Hero was bred to be a loving dog. That's his breed. He's a companion dog. So he's a naturally loving little guy. But I've never shouted at him. I've never spanked him. I've never even taken note of the bad things he does. When he steals my shoe, I simply take it away and put it somewhere where he can't get it. I create an environment for him in which it becomes almost impossible for him to do anything bad until he has the habit of just doing the good things. And I had a little bit of a struggle with that because he would sometimes sneak off and do something in another room when he wasn't looking. But I could see him out of my eyes, slinking out of the room and looking at me to see if I was watching where he was going. The anger and punishment do absolutely nothing to change people's behavior, except if you're angry and you punish someone, they'll find a way to get back at you sooner or later. And so what happens when we take these offenders bring them into jail is that they suffer greatly in jail. I mean, the food is horrible. I have to wash my clothes every day after work because it stinks so bad in the jail. It just smells awful, and I try to keep my, you know, the conditions are not... There are many people in the rest of the world who live under much worse conditions than our offenders in Canada. I will admit that. But the conditions in jail are unpleasant at the very best and awful, to say at the worst. And putting somebody in jail just makes them angry. And what they want to do is get revenge, just like we do. We want to get revenge on them because they did something bad. Now they want to get revenge on us because we did something that wasn't really working all that well. So the nice thing about Hero is that he responds really well. I don't have to give him treats. I don't have to bribe him to behave well. All I have to do is show him what I want him to do and celebrate his successes. And when he does it right, he is the happiest dog on the face of the earth. And I, of course, am the happiest and proudest owner because I got this all cased, right? So loving and forgiving people and then caring for them much in the way that the COSA folks do, the Circles of Support and Accountability, supporting them, is, in my opinion, the way to go in terms of changing people's behavior and creating a society that has less crime. And just so that, and I'm sure you all know this because you're a bunch of really smart, well-read, intellectual folks, crime is not going up in Canada. Crime is going down in Canada. White-collar crime is going up. But getting mugged on the street happens less and less frequently every year. So I think that's an interesting thing that we all need to take note of before we build more jails and impose longer sentences. Because the more jails and longer sentences means more personnel, and it also means a huge increase in what it costs us as taxpayers, and it changes the focus of who we are as Canadian society. I personally don't want to be focused on what's wrong with us. I would like to be focused on what's right with us. So, somebody said this, and I never remember who. The evolution of a society can be evaluated by looking at how its weakest members are treated. How do we treat the poor? How do we treat the mentally ill? How do we treat offenders and criminals and other marginalized populations? What do we do with those people? Well, right now we put them all in jail. That's our solution to dealing with the mentally ill, especially, and quite often to the poor. Getting tough on crime doesn't mean longer sentences in more jails. Getting tough on crime means getting tough on ourselves. Putting a guy in jail is the lazy way to go about correcting behavior. It means getting tough on crime means disciplining ourselves to create a more loving and caring and forgiving community, in which sanctions for breaking the law or law-breaking behaviors are genuinely intended to protect and correct rather than to punish. So I know 25 after 11, and I always talk longer than I intended to. Would you like to take time now for questions, or would you like to save that till lunch?
A service. Oh, it is working? Yeah. A service leader. I think we have just a couple of minutes for questions. So, okay, there's our first one.
My name is Myris Becker, and I believe I like your idea of healing rather than punishment. But if I lived in a society, well, say like Syria, where they came in and raped and robbed and killed my family. I don't know. I think my baser nature would take over, and I don't think I'd have the ability to forgive. Okay. And also, having been brought up in a traditional Christian society, and as you say, that's not the way you are now, do your Christian, in brackets, friends consider you a heathen?
Sorry, I didn't catch the last part.
Do your Christian friends consider you a heathen?
Do my Christian friends consider me a hero?
No, a heathen.
A heathen. No, they don't. I'm picky. And my parents don't know. I kept that. I learned a long time ago that if I want to talk issues of spirituality with certain people, I just have to learn their language, because I know that many people aren't willing to learn mine. They don't understand it. I came home from Egypt or from Africa with a Muslim boyfriend many, many, many years ago. My dad said he doesn't believe in God. I said, he believes in Allah. Allah is the Arabic word for God. It's just a question of language. And I think a lot of spiritual issues and a lot of spiritual conflict is just that. It's an issue of language. We do see things in similar ways in many instances. So. And no, they don't consider me a heathen.
I was just wondering about restorative justice and what role that is playing right now in with the correctional system. Like, this is something that I've heard has happened in some communities, restorative justice. And do you see this as something that is growing or something that's been put to the side or diminishing?
Well, the Correctional Service of Canada has a restorative justice award that's given every year. So there is some encouragement. And interestingly enough, this restorative, it's called the Ron Weeb Award. And Ron Weeb is a Mennonite from way back. Now, the Mennonites are very much involved in the restorative justice movement. And that was one of the things, that the involvement of the church that I go to now, very involved in COSA and very involved in person-to-person and other restorative justice kinds of projects, and that's one of the things that I appreciate about that congregation. Having said that, there might be in all of Canada 3 official positions within CSC for people who do restorative justice work. I would like to see restorative justice become our way of doing things, but I don't know that that's going to happen in my lifetime. I do what I can do with my offenders in working through their issues with respect to the crimes that they've committed, and that involves sometimes talking to them about things like restorative justice. Would you benefit from a face-to-face encounter with your victim where you can accept from your victim all their feelings and all their thoughts about what was done to them, and in a loving and a caring environment? So in answer to your question, I doubt it, but it would be nice.
Did you? I was so caught up in the last comment, it more or less touches on what I was going to ask you. I'm scared to ask you this. To what degree do you think that CSA shares your philosophy about correction and the concept of services? If you don't want to answer that, please don't.
I can talk about it from a personal point of view. A number of years ago, there was an offender who used to drop into my office from time to time, and he just to chat. Well, he wasn't a counseling client. And one day we were leaving my office. We were walking together as we were leaving my office, and he said to me, "Somebody told me that I shouldn't pay much attention to you because you're too soft." you're too naive with the word. I knew the person, and it was a staff member who had spoken to him, which is like you really just don't do that. But anyway, I thought about how I was going to deal with it. And I waited for the opportunity to come up, and when I was speaking with him, this fellow, he actually happened to be my boss and still is. And I said, you know, sometimes people think of me not as being naive and ignorant. I said, they should really be more careful how they see me, because I'm tough as nails. And I'm not nobody gets the jump on me, and nobody gets to manipulate me. Being loving and caring doesn't always mean being a soft touch. So I know what's going on. Sometimes, if a fellow's trying to manipulate me, I will let him go and see where he's going with it, just to gather more information with which to treat him later on. And so then it was dealt with. But that's kind of how people see me. I spent quite a lot of time working with sex offenders. And I was walking out of the institution one day, and one of the correctional officers said to me, "What kind of a woman works with sex offenders?" And I said, "You know, I'm not really sure, but I guess kind of woman who has the intestinal fortitude to do it." I didn't use that word. "And you're probably pretty lucky that she does it, because otherwise you'd have to do it."
Hi, Terry. I just wondered if the John Howard Society is still around, because they focus, don't they, on the sort of restorative justice model, and bringing the victim and perpetrator together. But is it only for sort of not very serious crimes?
The John Howard Society is still very active. I don't know much about it, because I'm not involved with that end of things. But we do have a social worker in our institution who works with offenders who are going to have really specialized needs. Our mental health guys. So she'll make sure that they have a psychiatrist in the community, and she'll contact the John Howard Society and make sure that somebody will sort of take his hand and show him the ropes once he gets out. So, yeah, they're still fairly active. It's my understanding they're more active down east than they are here. But
okay, we'll just take this one last question.
I agree with you completely as it relates to individuals, but there are certain institutions in society that I hate. Now, should I try to be more loving?
Oh, I hear you. Oh, it is so hard to love my bank. It is really, really hard to love the oil companies. And I guess from a psychological point of view, we need to recognize that what fuels a lot of those large institutions is a different expression of psychopathy. So those, in order to get to the top of a huge multinational oil company, you had to have not cared very much about whose head you stepped on the way. It just doesn't happen in any other way. And so, so there is that psychopathy, and you know you're never going to get any love back from a psychopath. It ain't ever going to happen. The answer is yes, you got to love them anyway, and you got to understand that they're really messed up. And by virtue of the fact that we involve ourselves, and this is now sort of moving off topic, but if you want the oil companies to quit doing business, you have to quit doing business with them, right? If it were not for all of us, they wouldn't be making any money. My guitar teacher, who lives in San Luis Obispo, California, and who I take lessons from by Skype, gave me a little lecture yesterday on the one world government of multinational oil companies, and they run the world, and as long as they're running the world, well, we can expect to be extinct in, you know, X number of years. Well, it's our choice. It is our choice to do business with the oil companies. It was my choice to drive down here yesterday instead of taking the bus. It's my choice to, you know, avail myself of all the benefits of having using fossil fuels. So unless I'm willing to stop doing that, they're going to run the show. My choice to make use of the banks and financial institutions, is it not? I mean, I could have chosen to live in a different place with fewer amenities, and I wouldn't have had to borrow money to buy my home, and I wouldn't, and so on and so forth. So I'm making choices here, too, that allow those people to be the way they are, or those institutions to be the way they are.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Terry.
Thank you.